Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It was supposed to be just another diplomatic barbecue, a chance for China's departing president to open the collar of his shirt, have a little Crawford kickback for the cameras. Now, it turns out that uninvited guests from North Korea are crashing tomorrow's party, at least in spirit. The regime's recent disclosure of its nuclear weapons program and hints that it has other weapons of mass destruction is turning a U.S.-China picnic into a more urgent moment of statecraft. The American administration says the situation with Pyongyang can be diffused diplomatically, and the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, is going to some lengths to make the case that North Korea is different from Iraq.
We have no military plans on the table right now for such an invasion of North Korea. They're not identical situations. They're quite different. Saddam Hussein has used weapons of mass destruction against his neighbors. Despite inspections, despite all the containment efforts we have made, he has not moved away from that policy. North Korea is a slightly different situation. It's a broken economy without access to resources, the way Saddam Hussein has access to resources. We have different levers we can use with North Korea, quite different than the levers available to us with respect to Iraq.
And China's President Jiang Zemin is one of those principal levers. His country shares a long land border and a long history with North Korea. China could be key to diffusing the nuclear tension. Connection listeners, should North Korea stand apart from Iraq as far as U.S. policy is concerned? Can the presidents, the prime ministers, and the diplomats talk this crisis through? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me today to look inside the conundrum of North Korea are two senior American diplomats who both held this file. Ash Carter is currently a professor of science and international affairs at the JFK School of Government at Harvard. James Lilly is a senior fellow with the American Enterprise Institute, formerly U.S. ambassador to Korea and China. Both men served as assistant secretaries of defense. Ash Carter under Clinton and James Lilly under George Bush Sr. Welcome to the program, both of you.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Mr. Lilly, how close now are China and North Korea?
Well, I think it's a rather mixed bag. I should say strategically, China wants to probably keep North Korea as a buffer zone for until they establish enough influence in the south to maintain their influence on the peninsula. But I think a couple of incidents recently have shaken the Chinese up. One is the North Korean mishandling of this economic zone in Sinuiju, with this big Chinese crook Yang Bin put in to run it. And the Chinese saw this as a inflow of drugs, prostitution, everything else. Second, I think the...
So this would be something that would convince the Chinese that they need to be more engaged, or something that separates the two?
Yeah, I would say tactically it separates them. It gets the Chinese fed up for the 455th time with North Korea. Second, I think the refugee flow, 300,000 perhaps North Korean refugees in China, escaping starvation, climbing over embassy walls in Beijing, is very humiliating for the Chinese, and they didn't like that at all. And finally, I think this breaking of the nuclear weapons agreement and building these weapons or uranium enrichment and admitting it, again, put the Chinese in a very tough spot because allegedly the technology came from Pakistan, and China is probably supplied the same kind of energy technology to Pakistan. So it's very awkward for the Chinese.
Ash Carter, but they don't
want these people to disappear.
Right. So, Ash Carter, in your view, does that mean that the Chinese have to move off their "we'd really rather not be involved in this sort of messy diplomacy" stump and get engaged in this?
Well, I've met with the Chinese leadership on North Korea several times in the course of conducting the North Korea policy review for President Clinton.
This you did from 98 to 2000.
Correct.
Right? Yeah.
Including with Jiang Zemin on several occasions. And the Chinese... At first, their view with us was, listen, you don't understand the North Koreans. We do. Keep your shirt on. We'll deal with it. They were always in agreement with us that they don't want a nuclear North Korea. nuclear North Korea to the Chinese is the beginning of a domino effect, potentially, in East Asia. They don't want the North Koreans to get them because they don't want the Koreans to get them, North and South. They don't want the Japanese to feel that they have to have nuclear weapons, which they might feel if Korea gets nuclear weapons. So nuclear proliferation in East Asia is bad for the Chinese, and they're very clear on that. They don't want war on the Korean Peninsula because that's a mess right on their border. It brings the Americans in more. They don't want that. So they were very clear that on the question of nuclear weapons and proliferation in North Korea, and Jiang Zemin was very clear, they were with us. And as Jim says, they have grown increasingly exasperated with the North Koreans. They were their communist and wartime allies in the 1950s, but gradually the Chinese have become disenchanted. They try to keep their old avenues open into the North, which are the party-to-party, Communist Party to Communist Party channels, which increasingly the Chinese don't really believe in, but the North Koreans do fervently, and the old military to military channels, but those old generals are all dying off. So everybody, including the Chinese, much less so than us, but still to some extent, are feeling they're losing their grip on these mysterious and strange people, and the North Koreans, losing their last friend in the world, China, are getting more and more isolated.
I'd like to follow through on what Ash just said.
Go ahead.
In 85, we briefed the Chinese when I was with Vice President Bush at the highest level on the North Korean conventional force deployments up against the DMZ, the formidable nature of it and the threatening nature of it. And at that time, the Chinese accepted our briefing on Vietnam, but they rejected the briefing on North Korea. They said, you don't know what's happening. Then in 90, when I was ambassador in China, we briefed them again on Yongbyon nuclear reprocessing facility. And they sat there and they didn't say anything. So I think now they have agreed with us, as Ash says, they don't want a nuclear weapon, North Korea. And they're faced with a real dilemma on this. I think the differences lie in tactics used to deal with this situation. They tend to agree more with Kim Dae-jung, the president of South Korea, that you have to do it by dialogue and by diplomacy. Whereas I think we see this needs probably stronger measures to get what we want done.
I'm looking at a quote from the current ambassador, Thomas Hubbard, who's quoted in the paper as saying that on the idea of talks, there's very little basis for trust and confidence that dialogue will lead to a solution. That seems quite a divergent perspective for Bush to be taking into a meeting with Jiang Zemin.
Well, it's perhaps a long shot dealing with the North Korea diplomatically. The only thing one can say in favor of the administration's position at the moment, which is to take a diplomatic shot at it, is that the situation on the ground does give us time for that. This is another difference that Colin Powell might have cited between this situation and Iraq. Let's think about the time scales of these two programs. The plutonium program, which was the one we know about, and the one we've talked to them about in the past, has produced 5 or 6 bombs worth of plutonium. That plutonium is sitting at Yongbyon, the facility that Jim mentioned.
That's the nuclear reactor that they do have.
They have a reactor there, and they have a reprocessing facility.
Right.
And the fuel has been irradiated, taken out of the reactor. That fuel now contains enough plutonium for 5 or 6 bombs. It has been that way since 1994. In 1994, the North Koreans were taking the fuel rods out, intending to reprocess them and make 5 or 6 bombs. That was the last time we had a crisis and almost went to war. That plutonium we put in containers and had on-site inspection, and it is sitting there at Yongbyon now. It has not been made into bombs, but it's still there, and if North Korea wants to, it can go in, take the plutonium out, and make 5 or 6 bombs in short order. Then there's the uranium program, which is the new development.
This is the enriching of the uranium, which could also be used.
There are two ways to make nuclear bombs, a plutonium way and a uranium way, and the North Koreans started on the plutonium route. Now they're diversifying and doing the uranium route. And we've caught them beginning to enrich uranium. Now, but the pace at which they can accumulate a bomb or 2 or 3 or 5 bombs worth of uranium is very slow. You make it in small quantities in an enrichment program. So from a purely military point of view, the uranium program isn't going to produce any bombs anytime soon, and therefore Colin Powell is right to say we have time to talk to them about that. From a purely military view, we do.
I do want to actually go a little bit further into where where the North Koreans are with their nuclear program. But the one thing that you two can both help us with is a sense of what that country is today. We know so little of North Korea that when I try to conjure up an image of a country like that, I end up with several silly sort of cartoon pictures of millions of people starving, millions of men in uniform, and other men in bad suits making bad decisions. And there's got to be more to that country. What can you give us as insight for the way that they're thinking? Jane, Ambassador Lilly, maybe you can start on that.
Well, I was in North Korea for about a week in 1995, and I would say the apt comparison is with George Orwell's 1984. Freedom is slavery, war is peace. They turn slogans on their head. There is a very affluent class, and there is tremendous poverty at the working level. They are not as enigmatic as you might say. I think we've negotiated with them for 50 years. We've gone through the Military Armistice Commission, the Agreed Framework, and other areas where we've talked with them. And you can see what their objectives are. And I think we're beginning to build up an ability to deal with it. For instance, right now, there is no military option in North Korea. They're just, you don't do that. South Korea would never sit still for it because they take immense losses immediately. Where your leverage lies is in the economy, and the North Koreans have telegraphed their punches on this. Money, money, money. Entrance into international financial institution loans, food, oil, etc., to let them survive. I think now we'll put this on a much more quid pro quo basis. I hope we will not be giving them unconditional food aid. I hope that we make the next delivery of oil dependent on some concrete actions on their part. They will react to that. And resolution, as Baker said in his editorial in the Washington Post yesterday, resolution, toughness, and a degree of compatibility with them, I think can get you through this. In 1976, for instance, when they axe-murdered two Americans, now that axe is in their museum as memorabilia for a great triumph. And that's what made our own current president very upset when he heard this. But they did this, axe-murdered the two Americans. General Stilwell, who was then the commander-in-chief in Korea, flew B-52s over the demilitarized zone. The North Koreans knew all about arc light strikes in Vietnam. And they backed off. And Kim Il-sung came as close as any time at that time to offer an apology. Certainly after the K-858 blew up in 1987, they blew up a South Korean airplane with 115 people on it. At that point, they shrunk back. But the sort of tricky insidiousness of it is that they gave us signals before they pulled the act of sabotage, as they did in Rangoon in 83 when they killed most of the South Korean cabinet. They give you indications that they're becoming peaceful, and then they turn on you.
So, Ash Carter, what's the indication we're getting now?
People always ask me what's going on in the North Korean mind, and since I've spent a lot of time with them and studying their mind, I tell people they are what they seem to be. Everything you see, the bizarre rhetoric, as Jim says, the behavior of a Stalinist throwback, that's there. And they coexist in their minds, and this is the answer to your question, two ideas that perfectly happily coexist in their minds. One is that we have to have weapons of mass destruction because that's our only way of keeping you away. And the other idea is maybe you'll give us something for our weapons of mass destruction.
Connection listeners, we come back to continue the conversation about North Korea after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. With me on the program today, former Ambassador James Lilly. He's now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Affairs under the Bush administration, was U.S. Ambassador to both China and Korea, co-editor of a book called China's Military Faces the future. With me in the studio, Ash Carter, from 98 to 2000, was official senior advisor to the North Korea Policy Review, is co-author of Preventative Defense, A New Security Strategy for America, with former Defense Secretary William Perry, and is currently professor of science and international affairs at Harvard University's JFK School of Government. He was also assistant secretary of defense for international security policy from 93 to 96. Our numbers, 1-800-423-8255. Let me start, if I can, with you, Ash, because in the days leading up to all the news about what it is North Korea has in terms of what it's choosing to reveal concerning its nuclear weapons and perhaps other weapons of mass destruction, were a collection of, quite frankly, bizarre stories of North Koreans revealing that they had kidnapped Japanese tourists decades ago and were deciding to release them. So in coming to terms with this startling admission to the American envoy, how do we understand what it is the North Koreans are actually saying?
They're saying two things at once, and we can hear one and not hear the other, as needs to be our approach. The two things they're saying are, on the one hand, are, we know you're out to get us. You've said we're in the axis of evil. You're after Saddam Hussein, but we seem to have all the attributes of Saddam Hussein also, and we know you're out to get us. Therefore, our only way of protecting ourselves is with nuclear weapons. That's what they said to Jim Kelly. At the same time, they're saying, our economy's going down the drain. Everybody in the entire world, with the only partial exception, as Jim and I said earlier, of China, are against us. And we need to somehow get out of our Stalinist economy and our Stalinist situation. Remember, this is a country that has had three generations of Stalinist political indoctrination. Children have political education for 4 hours a day. Remember Albania in 1990? Well, this is Albania for another 10 years of running a country like that. So they know their economy is failing. The regime is desperate to hang on. And half of it says to itself, the only way I can hang on is by having nuclear weapons and then nobody will mess with me. And the other half says, maybe I can trade this for another year or another 10 years or some sort of economic rescue. Kim Jong-il, the leader, I think looks out upon the world of post-communist societies and he says, well, I see a spectrum out there. On the one hand, on one end of the spectrum is Deng Xiaoping of China. He opened up China. He survived. He's lionized. He did well. In the middle of the spectrum is Mikhail Gorbachev. He opened up the USSR, but they hate him there. But he's alive. He's not in jail. Speaker's fees are good. And at the other end of the spectrum is his father's best friend, Nicolae Ceausescu. And his post-communist transition led to him being taken out in the backyard and shot. And Kim Jong-il is doubtless wondering where on that spectrum he might end up if he ever takes the lid off this last Stalinist throwback.
So, James Lilly, tell me what you would be advising President Bush to say to President Jiang at the meeting in Texas tomorrow.
I think he would first start off by saying we have a common problem. We don't want nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula, and we're both seeking economic reform of that broken economy. You have done it. You've set a model. We are willing to help them achieve economic reform. But they have to do something about their weapons of mass destruction, which you don't want. So you and I have a common goals in terms of somehow getting these people to reform agriculture, instead of giving them food, teaching them how to irrigate, fertilize, reforest, decollectivize, the things that will make agriculture work. But let me just add one more thing to a point that you were making, what makes the Koreans the way they are, mm-hmm. the North Koreans. They are a Confucian communist society, but they have a concept called Han, which in Chinese characters means Hun, hate. But in Korea, it means the whole world is dumping on us. It's a very pessimistic outlook. And it goes way back in history. And they are sitting there, a shrimp among whales, with China, Japan, and Russia around them. They've always been pillaged, colonized, raped for 1,000 years. I think 800 separate invasions. They really have a big chip on their shoulder. I know that Kim Dae-jung tried to convince Kim Jong-il that, look, our real problem is not the United States. It's the countries around us. The Americans being 10,000 miles away can actually give us stability. Think about it. Okay, I just want to get that concept in. But in terms of what we should do, I think we're doing the right thing. We're trying to get this cooperative effort going with Russia, Japan, China, South Korea, to use our very powerful economic leverage to get these people, A, to reform their economic system, and B, curtail their weapons of mass destruction program. I think that's the tack we should take and work it out with John, because he's a very key player.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to Lowell, Massachusetts now. John's on the line. Hi, John.
Hi, Dick?
Yeah.
Yeah. This seems kind of funny to me. I had a question and I still have it if I could ask it, but I wanted to make a comment.
Go ahead.
You've got two government guys here that have been paid very well by the former administrations, talking about our policy and sort of doing what I would consider propaganda. And I'm not hearing any challenge or any opposition to some of the things that they're saying.
What would you challenge, John?
Well, I challenge just about everything they're saying, actually.
Well, pick something. Be specific.
Well, first of all, I might have a guest on that wasn't employed by the government at some time.
So, well, actually, neither of these people, to the best of my understanding, are currently employed by the government. They both did work,
and they were well paid by them, and they know where their bread's buttered.
John, get to the point. What would you challenge about what you're hearing from them?
Well, that's part of the point. Is that you've got some people on here that you should be challenging most of what they're saying.
John, I'm going to let you go unless you can come up with something that you'd like to hear that you're not hearing on the program.
So here's my question. The question is, how do we detect the weapons in North Korea, enrichment of the uranium? Is that the same way that we could detect the same sort of activity in Iraq if we needed to? And if so, would that give us enough warning to make sure that we didn't have to actually go and kill thousands of people over there?
Ask Carter.
That's a good. It's a good question because it gets at the difference between the Iraqi situation and the North Korean situation. This isn't a show about Iraq, but we do not know exactly where the Iraqi nuclear program is, and that's one of the issues of debate about whether we should go after Iraq right now. How close are they? We know a little bit better where North Korea stands. In the plutonium program, we know that there are 5 or 6 bombs worth of plutonium sitting there in Yongbyon. Within a few weeks, North Korea can go in, take that plutonium, and make bombs with it. So that's a threat that's right in front of our face right now, but it's one that
that's not new. We've known that for 8 years.
We've lived with that for 8 years, and they have not made bombs out of it for 8 years. And we know that, John, because we're on the ground there in Yongbyon, and we watch those fuel rods. The uranium program is different. We don't know everything we'd like to know about that. We picked that up, John, through sensitive intelligence sources that I at least talk about, but we do know that it's a slowly developing program. That is, that it's not going to accumulate 5 or 6 bombs worth of material for a long time. And it's those two facts, that we have an imminent threat that we've dealt with diplomatically before and lived with, but it's still there on the plutonium side, and on the uranium side, something that's developing, that's dangerous, but isn't going to turn into bombs within a few weeks, and therefore we have time to talk to the North Koreans along the lines that Jim and I have been talking about their other problems, and see if they're willing to come to their senses. The one thing that's real important to keep in mind, I think, is remember why it is that we cannot really why it would be extremely dangerous to let North Korea succeed in becoming a nuclear power. The one reason, very important, is that we now have a situation on the Korean Peninsula where war, North Korean invasion of South Korea is deterred by the fact that they know they would suffer a certain defeat at the hands of U.S. and South Korean defensive forces. If they got nuclear weapons, they might come to believe that they could scare away or chase away South Korea's defenders, and that would make war on the Korean Peninsula more likely. That's one reason. A second reason is if North Korea gets nuclear weapons, as I said earlier, well, who's next? South Korea, we've convinced South Korea, which had a nuclear program itself once upon a time, not to get nuclear weapons. They didn't need them, and North didn't have them. Therefore, they didn't need to have them.
So take
they
Iraq.
Might change their mind.
Take Iraq out of the equation, Ambassador Lilly, and does the American-Chinese response to this threat of nuclear weapons in North Korea then have much wider implications for nuclear proliferation either within Asia or beyond?
Well, I think Ash is right. You've got to stop it right in North Korea, because we stopped it in South Korea and in Taiwan, stopped them very effectively. And therefore, China knows that we've worked to stop this in states that they consider potentially unfriendly. So we know that we can do that. Right now, it seems to me our greatest leverage is the food and the oil. We Americans have poured in perhaps about $800 million since 1993-94 in terms of oil, heavy oil and grain. The Chinese have probably put in 1 million tons or so of grain a year. The Japanese have set up funds. The South Koreans have really poured money into North Korea. North Korea becomes dependent on that, almost like an addict. And when you start pulling back on that and creating disincentives, very strong disincentives, for them to not to engage in weapons of mass destruction, that's quite effective. When the Japanese, for instance, in 1980, the North Koreans shot a rocket over the Japan, a three-stage
missile. I remember that.
Yeah, the Japanese then immediately canceled all talks and stopped all aid. The North Koreans got the message. And recently, as you know, they've said certain conciliatory things to the Japanese in the face of really very hostile anti-Japanese propaganda for many, many years. And, of course, the Japanese were not Boy Scouts when they occupied the Korean Peninsula for 35 years from 1910 to 45. So it seemed, I think we're working out ways that we can influence them.
Right.
And we got to bottle it up and keep it in there and get rid of it. And I think this is the best chance we have.
Let's go to Durham, North Carolina. Izana is on the phone. Hi, Izana.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
No, thank you. It's just I have a problem with the U.S. policy trying to be a judge as far as what is going on with the nuclear war and who should get what, who should not get what. And during the Cold War, I think this made sense. But I was reading an article yesterday, for example, that the Chinese are going fast with the information technology system, and they have over 600,000 electrical engineer graduates. And America, last year we had 70,000 electrical engineering graduates, and out of this, 54% were foreigners going back to their countries. The research and development that was allocated, for example, last year on the electronics sector was less than $5 billion, which is what Microsoft and Intel spent altogether.
Izana, are you saying that the idea of even having conversations about weapons is wrong, that what the United States needs to do is use its technological might to try and break these countries from the inside?
Well, some sort like that. But my idea is the fact that we are so much in focus as far as all these things. I'm sure that there is a point to it, but I think we're missing the point as far as there is the future power is on information, not so much on weapon as
But the power of the information is only power in the hands of the people, Izana, and it seems to me that the one thing that's peculiar about North Korea is that the people themselves don't have that power.
But let me pose a question for one of you guests.
Sure.
When is it right? I mean, okay, today is North Korea. Yesterday was this. Tomorrow will be Pakistan, India. Pretty soon, I mean, the U.S. cannot go and say, okay, you cannot hold this, you can't do this, you can't do this. Pretty much the U.S. will try to run the world. I mean,
so turn it into a question, Izana.
When do we draw the line? When do we draw the line and say, okay, you are free to do this as long as you don't do this?
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Ash Carter.
Well, I think the one place to draw the line is at weapons of mass destruction. And In the case of North Korea, we have not contested with them that they have 1 million men on the DMZ. We're not telling them we have to have a peace treaty after 50 years of being in an official state of war with North Korea. We're not even telling North Korea that the way they treat their population and their communist government are abhorrent to us and we can't tolerate it. We've told the North Koreans many times, if you cut it out with the weapons of mass destruction, we're not out to get you. But the weapons of mass destruction creates a problem that's larger than you. All of your neighbors agree with us about that. The entire world agrees that North Korea should not have nuclear weapons, and they don't need that for their people. And the way that they can manage some transition from the dismal state of their economy now to some future that's better for their people, we're prepared to assist in that. We certainly won't obstruct that. But weapons of mass destruction make everything else much more dangerous and much more tenuous. So that whole future that our guest is talking about, information, prosperity, all the things that we value in modern life, all that can be brought to an abrupt halt by weapons of mass destruction.
But Ambassador Lilly, when the current U.S. president puts North Korea on the axis of evil, doesn't he also say beyond the leaders to the people that we want nothing to do with you? Just in terms of what Anna is saying about where you draw the line, did that go too far?
No. Well, I think a choice of words is not the issue right here. I don't think semantics are that important. I think what's much more important is the fact that North Korea has willingly and voluntarily signed on to international agreements that oblige them not to do what they're doing. The Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they signed on to it in 1985. This says you should not produce or export nuclear weapons and technology. They signed on to it. And now they broke it. They signed on to the agreed framework. They signed on with this joint agreement with the South Koreans in 1991 not to enrich uranium. And they broke it. Now we're talking about breaking international agreements which you've signed, in a very dangerous way. So this is an additional element why they should be treated in a very, I would say, resolute fashion.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And tomorrow, at about this time, President Bush will be meeting with China's President Zhang to talk about North Korea and whether or not any change in the statecraft will make any difference to North Korea's recent announcement that it, in fact, has nuclear weapons material and perhaps further weapons of mass destruction. We're talking about what the response to that could be that would be both creative and useful. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. North Korea, the subject of our conversation this hour. Recent announcement a surprise announcement from the North Koreans that they have nuclear weapons material that they would be able to use in the construction of a weapon, and that there may in fact be weapons of mass destruction different from nuclear weapons also in the country. And with me on the program, James Lilly, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. He was assistant secretary of defense for international affairs under the previous Bush administration. Ash Carter is also with us. He was also assistant secretary of defense for international security policy. That's from 93 to 96 under Clinton. He's currently professor of science and international affairs at Harvard University's JFK School of Government. And Mr. Carter, in 94, when you were in that Defense Department position, you were one of the architects of a deal in 94, in which the North Koreans were threatened, if I understand it rightly, by the United States, that they had to stop the production of plutonium at that point. That they were warned by the Americans that they would be that reactor would be bombed if they didn't stop it. It got a little bit close to the edge, and a deal was struck. But the deal was supposed to perhaps not to the letter, but in spirit, give the rest of the world an assurance that the idea of North Korea producing nuclear weapons was set aside. Now, have they broken that? Did you make a mistake? Should something have been done differently in 94 so we wouldn't be where we are now?
I thought in 1994, from the point of view of the Pentagon, that we would the odds were better than 50-50, we would have a war on the Korean Peninsula. The then Secretary of Defense and I have revealed this. We had a plan in 1994 to attack Yongbyon, which was an operating nuclear reactor at the time, from the air, do it unilaterally, that is U.S. only, an attack that we're confident would have destroyed that reactor, entombed the plutonium within it, and made it impossible for North Korea anytime soon to get that plutonium. I thought we were quite likely to end up launching that strike. That would have been a surgical strike that would have taken care of the problem at the time. However, in Korea, no strike is surgical because that probably, an attack upon North Korea probably would have caused North Korea's large, backward, but fanatical army to swarm across the DMZ, unleashing a war, which we're also prepared for. We also have a plan for, and we have for many years, and we're confident we would win that war. But that's a very, very bloody war. It's not like Desert Storm. It's not out in the desert somewhere. It's a war that takes place in the suburbs of Seoul. Therefore, we were glad when we were able to persuade North Korea to step back from getting that plutonium out in 1994. That's what the agreed framework did. Now, it didn't do everything, and it didn't do things for all time. All it did was oblige the North Koreans to not to take the plutonium out and make bombs with it, that it was at Yongbyon. And we didn't rely on trust. We said we have to be able to go to Yongbyon and verify that that fuel is not being reprocessed into plutonium. And we've been there. We know it is not.
But if the North Koreans are enriching uranium, then they've just basically found a way around the 94 agreement?
And that's exactly right. And in 1994, I knew that this agreement was not for all time. All we were doing, with the word we used was freeze. We froze the North Korean nuclear program. That plutonium's still there, and now they're at work on uranium. So if you make a deal with the North Koreans, whatever you ask for, you need to make sure that you are able to verify. So if we do negotiate a deal, which I hope we're able to do, right, on the uranium program, we're going to need to be sure on the spot that they're doing what they say they do. Because what they've shown is that anything that they haven't specifically signed up to do and you can't verify, they'll work around.
Ambassador Lilly, I mean, it feels to me like the spirit of the agreement was broken. What should happen next?
Well, I think we're doing that now, and I think you've put your finger on this very key meeting with Jiang Zemin in Crawford, Texas, that the Chinese did go along with us in 1990 to impose sanctions on Iraq. They abstained on the use of force resolution. But I think this time they'll be even more cooperative. Looks like Russia and France are taking the lead in the Security Council to force us to take a more flexible position. But I think that the Chinese foreign policy, and there's a good piece in the newspapers this morning on this, is moving in a more moderate direction. It's a good time to start talking with them about this. But I'd only say one thing, Ashton, where I don't think that war was as close, perhaps, as you said. Oh, yes, perhaps we were going to hit them. I don't think we could have, in view of the terrible reaction it would have created. I think the North Koreans are masters at brinksmanship and bluff. They've been doing it for 50 years, threatening North Korea, and threatening South Korea, threatening us with military attack. And unfortunately, after the agreement was made, our people here that supported the agreement used to go to the Congress to get oil out of Congress, money for it, and say the North Koreans will make war if we don't do this. And that threat they used again and again. The war thing went on and on and on. It was like crying wolf. Now they aren't quite as stuck on this thing. I think right now they realize that we've got them in terms of economic leverage.
Well, Jim, I hope you're right that we weren't close to war in 1994, but it certainly felt that way, and we were certainly prepared for that. North Korea is an unpredictable enough country. It has this huge army poised on the DMZ. Its propaganda at the time was saying that it was going to construe our actions as an act of war. Those of us in the Defense Department felt we had to take that seriously. And we also thought it was quite likely that were we to strike Yongbyon, that would not be the end of the matter. That would be the opening of a war on the Korean Peninsula. So it seemed dangerous to us at the time. I do agree with you that the North Koreans are masters at brinksmanship. And probably what that means is that as we talk to them about this uranium program, what the administration has indicated it's going to do, they'll probably take us to the brink again. That's their style.
Our number is 1-800. I'm going to move ahead to calls, if you don't mind, Ambassador. 1-800-423-8255-2, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Louis on the line. Hi, Louis. Louis, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, Louis, go ahead.
Sorry, not Louis. My name is Brad from North Carolina.
Well, I've got the wrong lineup. My apologies, but Brad, you've got the mic. Go ahead.
Okay. Question that's come up in my mind time and time again. What benefit did the North Koreans have for announcing this? Announcing, okay, here's where we are. I mean, is this part of a bluff? Is this a plan? Are they trying to show force? Why didn't they just suddenly this?
It's an interesting question, actually, on both sides. Why did they blurt out that, yes, indeed, we're doing it? And you can also ask the question, why did we ask them? Because
well, I think
our
right
information
now
was based on very sensitive intelligence information. But the administration evidently felt it had to confront North Korea on this. At the same time, I think the administration's silence for 12 days after confronting the North Koreans meant that we hadn't really thought through what we would do if we got the answer that we got. On the North Korean side, I think that they're doing their standard act, which is to threaten us, try to shake us up, and see what they can get.
Ambassador?
I agree with him. I think they've got a variety of reasons, usually when you try to analyze their actions. Number one, we confronted them with it. And I think they had to accelerate their plan for revelation because I think they were going to do it anyway. But Kelly hitting them with this, they had to answer back. And they did catch us off guard, I think, on that. But number two, I think Ash is right. They're going to use this as a leverage to get more food, more money out of us. I think that's clear, very clear. But finally, I think it's interesting that recently we've seen them beginning to pull groups together and talk about having more small conventional power stations. The whole idea of the light water reactors, 2 1,000-megawatt reactors, really powerful. They had no grid system that could really handle it. They'd need another probably $500 million to build that, and they'd stick with us with a bill. And also, they were not going to allow inspections as called for in the agreed framework. Therefore, we could not move in the real nuclear power stations until they submitted to those inspections, which would probably reveal their past nuclear weapons program, the dimensions of it. So I think they had a number of reasons. Money, perhaps changing the equation from nuclear power to conventional power. And three, we caught them. And it was more difficult for them in the recent pattern that they've taken on revelation and even apology. This seems to be in that sort of stream.
Interesting little footnote to that. Jim Kelly has said that the first day they denied it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the next morning they came back and admitted it. And to our caller's question, they told Jim Kelly they had stayed up all night, pulled a college all-nighter trying to figure out what to say. And by morning they had decided just to fess up.
See, the other thing you can both help me with is an understanding of how this will be seen on the other side of the Pentagon doors, because you've got Iraq is a very lively file right now. The Middle East is not going anywhere. You've got the work in Afghanistan that continues. Overlying all this, you have the war on terror. Was it then a particularly clever moment for the North Koreans to make such a bold admission, perhaps with the idea that there are just too many other irons in the fire for the Americans to deal specifically with this.
The North Koreans are master tacticians. They don't know where they're going strategically. They're not very good at the long run, clearly. But they're master tacticians. They know we're all tangled up on the question of Iraq and that this isn't a bad moment. Because an administration that might have reacted more sharply is instead doing, and I think wisely, saying, well, we have the time. We might as well talk to these guys as long as we have that time. The North Koreans were able to figure that out, that we have other preoccupations, first bin Laden, then Saddam Hussein, and only then them. And so it's not a bad time to have at us.
Ambassador,
Two things. First of all, we've also got the leverage in this Japanese normalization process. The Japanese have dangled the pot of gold in front of the North Koreans, $5 to $10 billion in a compensatory package. And the North Koreans salivate at this. And the Japanese said, unless you do something about your weapons program, that could be slowed down or stopped.
Haven't they promised the Japanese that they'll put an embargo on weapons testing until 2003? Haven't they promised the Japanese that with the prospect of getting their hands on that money, that they'll open themselves up to weapons inspection?
I think that this is a strong incentive for them to do it. It's also, if it's a disincentive, too. If you don't do this, the pot of gold shrinks away. So I think that's really a very important consideration at this point.
So does Junichiro Koizumi then become the point person for...
I think Japan has a definite role if you're going to use economic leverage. It's clearly they are important in this. But in the negotiations, South Korea takes a good role, I think, a solid role. It's a carrot and a stick. We are basically more the stick. South Korea is the carrot. South Korea has been very generous to the North, and President Kim Dae-jung has an election coming up where his protege may lose because of resistance to his sunshine policy, which many South Koreans consider a giveaway without reciprocity. But they also they don't want war in the peninsula, and they want us to continue to engage the North because I think they think that they have a plan to draw North Korea in. I've heard them tell this to me a number of times, what they are thinking of in terms of drawing the North Koreans in. And they say, give us time and we'll get them. But so, I think they're going to have a problem.
So whether it's the Japanese or whether it's the Chinese or the South Koreans who are leading this, how far will the North Koreans, how close to the brink will they take this?
They'll probably take it to the brink. And if we're clever, we will line everybody up, all our allies. This is in response to one of your earlier questioners was asking about unilateralism. This is something which we will do with Japan, with South Korea, and with China, because they all have carrots of a kind that we're not prepared to give to North Korea. We'll front the negotiations. The North Koreans always want to talk to us. But to be effective, it has to be a team effort. And in previous times, we've managed to have the South Koreans, the Japanese, and the Chinese all with us.
But this could get a little bit or a lot more tense before a resolution?
Yeah, knowing the North Koreans, they will take us right up to the brink. So my guess is that you'll be talking about this more in the future, and this will not be a smooth negotiation. In fact, maybe we'll go back to where we were in 1994.
Well, I hope I can get both of you back to help me with that. Ash Carter, thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Ash Carter is Professor of Science and International Affairs at Harvard University's JFK School of Government. Ambassador James Lilly, thank you for your time.
Okay.
Mr. Lilly, former ambassador to China and Korea, now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.